Thank you, and good morning, everybody. My name is Bill Sanders, and I am an alcoholic. By the grace of God, I'm sober this morning, and that's the single most important thing that I'm going to tell you during this next hour, and that by the grace of a loving God and His gift of people like you in rooms like this, I have not found it necessary to take a drink today. That isn't so much the miracle. I like to say that the real miracle is that I didn't want to drink. And it's been a few 24 hours since I have. And for that, I am grateful, and I thank my God of my understanding every day. I want to know, what did you people do to get bandaged way up there in the peanut gallery? Oh, I see. Okay. Better than out in the parking lot, I guess. Well, I did want you folks to see that I can and do clean up well when I stay sober one day at a time, but this coat's got to go. When I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the first burning questions in my mind was trying to understand a term that I kept hearing in these meetings called an alcoholic personality. And I asked, God knows how many people, what is an alcoholic personality? And I got about 400 different answers, none of which I understood at all. Until an old-timer said, son, sit down, I got a little story I'm going to tell you. When I get through, you'll understand what an alcoholic personality is. And if you've heard this story before, guess what? You're going to hear it again. It's the story of a little drunk who was walking along the beach one day, and he found buried, half buried in the sand, a bottle. And he picked it up in high hopes of being able to uncork it and maybe get a few drops in the bottom of the bottle. And instead, when he uncorked it, there was suddenly a puff of smoke, and there standing in the sand in front of him was this fellow about 8 feet tall with a big turban on his head. The little drunk rubbed his eyes, blinked, and looked again. I mean, he'd had some bad DTs in his time, but he'd never seen anything like this. Suddenly it spoke. It said, I am your genie, and you have three wishes. What would you like? And he said, what is your first wish? He said, I'd like to have a bottle of bourbon that's never empty. Another puff of smoke, another instant there sitting in the sand in front of him was a jug of bourbon, and he uncorked it and sniffed it, and boy, was it the good stuff. He tilted it up and took a great big glug out of it, tilted it down and looked at it, and it was still right to the top. He turned that bottle back and he chugged at it for about 10 seconds. Pulled it down and looked at it, it was still right up to the top. The little fellow looked at Jeannie and then looked back at that bottle. He tilted up and he chugged away at it for about 45 seconds, most he'd had in a month. Pulled it down and looked at it. You couldn't miss a drop. It was all the way to the top. So Jeannie said, is that all right? He said, that's wonderful. He said, you have two more wishes. What would you like? He said, I want two more just like this one. So that's an alcoholic personality, folks. And I got to take your inventory for just a second and say to you that if you understood that story and you got the gist of that story, then you're in the right place this morning. But I'm going to tell you something. You go out here on Atlantic Avenue and you stop some people and you tell them that story, and they look at you real funny and they say, well, if this one's never going to be empty, why would they don't get it. They just don't get it. And they're not going to get it. And I quit trying to make them get it. They don't understand. But you people do understand, and you understood me when I showed up at your doors. For the first time in my life, I felt like I had found someone who did understand me. Because you see, my story, I can't go back to my first drink. I used to think I could, and that would be the beginning of my story, but it really wasn't. Actually, when I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you put me on a lie detector and asked me, Bill, when did you start drinking alcoholically? I would have said about 2-3 years ago, and I wouldn't have moved the needle an inch because I believe that. The longer I'm here, the further back it goes. Now, I believe with all my heart that I was born an alcoholic. At the age of 15, I began my journey toward becoming a full-blown drunk, and it took until I was almost 40 years old to become just an alcoholic again. And I say just an alcoholic because I don't have any trouble being an alcoholic. I am one of those people that I thought was an absolute nut when I got here that said I am grateful to be an alcoholic. I am grateful to be an alcoholic because it has brought me a way of life that I only could imagine in my other lifetime. My life began at a very early age in the hills of North... All right, I'll wait. In the hills of North Georgia, I was born into a very, very, very small town. I mean little. They used to say in my little hometown there in the hills of North Georgia, there were three things you could do on a Saturday night. You could watch them unload the truck at the A&P. You could watch the water tank leak. Or you could go across the Savannah River to South Carolina and you could buy beer. And I assure you, I did not get here from too much water tank watching. For as long back as I could remember, I was a very scared little boy. I never felt that I belonged anywhere. And there are a lot of people that I grew up with that even today wouldn't understand that, because if they remember me when I was growing up, they would know that I was in everything. I joined everything. I was a part of everything. At least I was a part in name and body. But I didn't feel a part of. No matter how many places I went, things I joined, I felt like a square peg looking for a round hole. I spent my whole life terrified of people. I can remember as a child, my mother would send me to the grocery store to find an item and bring it home, and I'd walk in that store, and rather than ask somebody where it was, I'd walk the aisles for 30 minutes if I had to. So afraid to ask somebody anything. When I was 15 years old, a group of friends said, "Hey, come on, go with us over to South Carolina and let's get some beer." And I don't know why, but either under peer pressure or curiosity or whatever, I said, okay. And we went over to this little place over across the river where they'd sell you beer. They didn't care how old you were. If you could babble out beer, they'd give it to you. And we went back with a case of beer and sat down on the banks of the old muddy Savannah River, and someone popped a church key into a Pabst Blue Ribbon and handed it to me. And I took a big old swallow of that stuff, and it was, beyond any shadow of a doubt, the most putrid, god-awful, vile-tasting stuff I had ever put in my mouth, and I only drank six that night. And I got drunk that night. It was all I could do to get that first beer down. I mean, it kept going here and coming back up here and going to, that's when I began to learn my first dose of going to any length. I was, we drunk knew how to do that before we got here. And then I started on the second beer. And somewhere about the middle of that second beer, something happened. And suddenly, I was wittier and smarter. The fear went away. I was handsomer, sexier than I had ever been in my life or anybody else I'd ever known in my life. And I knew that I had found a friend for life. There was magic in that can of beer. And it almost was a friend for the rest of my life. As most of you know how our stories go. Well, in high school, I didn't drink all that much. I would have, but it wasn't available. It was too far to go over to South Carolina, and if I'd gotten caught with it, my life would have been considerably shorter than it was already headed in the direction of being if my Southern Baptist teetotaling mother had caught me anywhere near a beer. But then, when I graduated from high school, as was told to you just a minute ago, I headed across about 40 miles to Athens, Georgia, to the University of Georgia, and there I got my first taste of anonymity. Because the student population of the university was almost twice that of my whole hometown, and nobody cared how much little Billy Sanders drank. So I started drinking every day. It didn't take me long at all to discover that liquor was a whole lot quicker, and I put beer behind me. Unless there wasn't anything else around, if there wasn't anything else around, I'd drink vermouth, if that's all I could get, or worse. And, a lot of Georgia Bulldogs get together and they talk about their grand old wonderful college days. And I can't do a whole lot of that because there's a whole lot of my college career that I don't remember. I got my first taste of blackouts. I didn't know that's what they were. But I do know I stayed in a lot of trouble during the 4 years that I stayed in Athens, Georgia. I got in so much trouble that the dean of men, Dean Bill Tate over there, had a bench outside of his office that got to be known as the Bill Sanders bench. Because I sat on it more than anybody else waiting to see him. And they almost threw me out of school several times for weird things. They're downright unpatriotic. I almost got thrown out of school for singing the Star Spangled Banner. Of course, it was to an empty flagpole at 3 o'clock in the morning in front of the infirmary. And I knew when Bill Tate pulled up in his old 56 Chevrolet with that overcoat over his pajamas that he wasn't thrilled to be there. And I certainly wasn't thrilled that he was there. There's another time that I almost got kicked out of school for doing something that's a great tradition at the University of Georgia. Any people that know anything about it know that after every time Georgia wins a football game, they ring the chapel bell. And they almost threw me out of school for ringing the chapel bell. Of course, this time it was on Easter Sunday morning at about 3 o'clock. And it wasn't Dean Tate that came that time. It was the mayor of Athens. And he looked even less thrilled. That's the way my college career rocked along. And I think except for Dean Bill Tate, who was determined some way, somehow, that I was going to finish the 4 years I had over there, I'm not sure I would have made it. But in the junior year of my college career, I applied for and got an opportunity to do an internship in my chosen profession, which was the broadcasting industry. And I had gone into that profession when I was 13 years old. At one time, supposed to have been the youngest disc jockey in the country. But always, 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 I had wanted a chance to work at the big 50,000-watt clear channel Voice of the South, WSB Radio and Television in Atlanta. Dream of every kid that studied that profession. And as fate would have it, my roommate and I got the only two internships out of about 400 that year. How, I don't know. But on a spring day of that year, we made the trip to from Athens to Atlanta in a car we had borrowed from a friend, and we went and found an apartment to live in that summer, and we spent the day visiting with people at the station. All of them were big celebrities to us, people we'd heard on radio and watched on TV all of our lives. And all of a sudden, we realized we were going to be working with them that summer. And then we decided afterwards to celebrate. We went out and had a few drinks and a few more drinks and a few more drinks. And then realized the lateness of the hour, and we had to get the car back to the friend we had borrowed it from, and we headed back for Athens. We got back over and we delivered the car to the friend that it belonged to and decided to have a few more drinks and celebrate. After all, this was the greatest day of our lives and just couldn't get any better than this. And as I drank, I was already then beginning to get a little crazy when I drank. Crazier. And I began to clown around and I reached up on the wall and I pulled down an old antique long-barreled Colt 22 pistol and started waving around in the air. Pointed at my roommate, and he stuck his hands up. I said, "Stick them up." And I pulled the trigger, and there was a sound like thunder. And in a moment, my roommate was lying on the floor in front of me in a pool of blood. A few hours later, at Athens Hospital, they were to tell us that my roommate Wayne would live, but that he would never walk again. The bullet had severed his spine. What was to have been the greatest day of my life had come crashing down. And a very strange thing happened in a hospital room in the early hours of the next morning. My roommate, coming out from under the anesthetic, his first operation, reached up and put his hand on my arm. And he said, "Bill, whatever you do, don't blame yourself for this. It was an accident. It could have just as easily been the other way around. I know you didn't mean to do it." He forgave me immediately. But I did not forgive me for more than 20 years. I used it as an excuse to crawl into that bottle and to set up housekeeping, to live there. I used it to beat myself up and as an excuse, and that's exactly what it was, an excuse to more quickly and more assuredly become the drunk that I was headed toward being. I went ahead that summer and fulfill that internship. It was to have been the most wonderful, fun experience of my whole life. Instead, it became a foggy, hazy nightmare. I'd get up and go to work at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, would work through the evening hours, and when the 11 o'clock news would be over at 11:30 every night, I'd stumble out of that station, cross the street to a bar, and sit down and start drinking, along with a bunch of other media people from around Atlanta. And I would drink until they'd close the bars about 2 o'clock, and if there were enough of us there, they'd just lock the doors and keep on serving. And we'd drink till 3 or 4 or 5 in the morning. At 5, I'd stumble out of that bar and into a cab and head to that loathsome apartment to sleep it off, get up the next morning and repeat the same cycle over and over and over. But at least it kept me going and it kept me busy. But that fall, when school time came again and I was back in Athens, it all came crumbling down. And I put a plan into motion. If you remember, there were, I think, 3 doctors at the old infirmary at the University of Georgia in Athens. I'd go to the doctors one after the other and tell them I was having trouble sleeping. They'd give me some sleeping pills, and they'd give me some pills, and I'd take them home and stash them in the nightstand of my dormitory room. The next day, I'd go to another doctor, and I'd ask him for some. Then I'd go to the third one. And I kept repeating, going over and over again, until I got a pretty good supply. And then I waited till one Friday afternoon when my new roommate was headed home for the weekend to show his family the new car he had purchased. Uh-oh. Sound system just went out again. Hello? A little better? Oh, well. But I waited until he was ready to go out of town to go home to his family. And I watched him pull out of the parking lot of the dormitory in his new car and out of sight. As soon as he got out of sight, I closed the blinds, sat down on the side of the bed. I opened up all those little bottles and dumped them out onto the nightstand and took a glass of water and downed them one by one and two by two. What was later determined to be between 50 and 60 sleeping pills. Turned out the lights and pulled up the cover. And I thought, for more than 20 years, that it was some kind of an incredible coincidence that my roommate's brand new car conked out at the city limits of Athens and had to be towed back. And that he came into that dormitory room and found me, found the bottle, put it all together as to what had happened, and called the ambulance. I said that I believe it was a coincidence because today I do not believe in coincidences. I love the definition I heard a few years ago, that a coincidence is a miracle in which God chooses to remain anonymous. I think in reality for me, I have to believe that that was the first time that the God of my understanding looked down and said, "Big boy, I am not through with you yet." And I say the first time because there were so many times of wrecked and total cars, of insane behavior, of winding up in places that I had no business being. And somehow, some way, he got me through it. You know, this always happens when you got a broadcaster at the microphone, you know. Oh, boy. Can y'all hear me up there okay? Okay, let's just don't worry about it, then. They took me to the hospital, of course, and pumped out my stomach. And it was after this incident that I began the great American tradition of visiting the friendly neighborhood shrinks. And over the years, I couldn't begin to tell you how many of these individuals I went to see. Psychologists, psychiatrists, counselors of every kind. And as I visited every one of them, I damned them and then paid them a fortune. Because they weren't helping me one bit. Now, I always say that since this is a program of rigorous honesty, I have to say that there is an outside chance that one or more of them might have been able to help me if I had ever told them the truth. But you know, if you've ever been to one of these people, about the third, fourth, or fifth question they always ask, "Do you think you might have a drinking problem?" And my standard answer was, "No, I drink fine." and they go off treating something else. Eventually, I did exit the University of Georgia, and I did exit the University of Georgia with a diploma in my hand. I have never been fully sure if I earned it or if they just got tired of me over there. And I ain't going to ask, because I've kind of gotten used to it hanging around on the wall these last 30 years, and I'm going to keep it. Eventually, I ended up north of Athens in a town of Gainesville, Georgia, not Florida, and went to work for a radio station there and decided I needed to clean up my act and become more of a pillar of the community and the kind of person that I always looked up to and would like to be. So I joined the church, and I joined civic clubs, and I became a scout commissioner, and I got involved in all kinds of good civic activity. Oh, I also joined a local fraternal order that had one of the very few bars in town. And guess which one got the most of my attention? You know, the one with the bar. Every afternoon at about 5:30, I'd hit that bar, and I'd stay till they closed. Somewhere along the way, in those few months after I went to Gainesville, I met a beautiful girl and fell immediately in love. And I knew that one of these days that I was going to marry that girl. And I did, and she became my first wife. And I knew also that when I got involved with this beautiful girl that I needed to straighten up my act, I needed to drink less, I needed to try to get my life together, until I made a wonderful discovery. That woman liked to drink just as much as I did. So we began our life together by hitting that bar every night and drinking until it closed. Occasionally we would interrupt and even have dinner or something. After we were married and bought a little home in Gainesville, and one day my wife came in and said, "We're going to have a baby." Well, we both talked about it and decided that we needed to clean our act up. We needed to drink less, and we needed to have a little bit more of a real home life, and made the decision. And when that baby came, that's exactly what we were going to do. And we did. We did. For several weeks. And then we discovered the great American institution called the babysitter. And we were freed up to head back to that club every night and to begin a pattern that was going to last for a long, long time. I know now that even before the baby arrived, and certainly in the year, months and years after the baby came, that our marriage began to crumble. It began to come apart at the seams. I do have to say that I have heard a lot of you people say in meetings and in telling your story that your marriage has failed because of communication problems. I didn't understand that. I still don't understand that, because my wife and I had no problems with communicating. We communicated. You could ask our neighbors three doors down the street, and they'd tell you, the Sanders communicate. They could even tell you what we were communicating about and how often. And these communication sessions usually followed a particular pattern. We'd launch off into one of these discussions, and I could hang in there with the absolute very best of them until I got on the losing end of it. And when it became apparent I was on the losing end of this discussion, I'd grab my bottle, storm out the door, slam it, get in my car, peel up the driveway, I'm out of here, I don't have to stay here and take this. Over and over and over and over again it happened. But there's one Sunday afternoon in particular that it happened. This particular Sunday afternoon we launched into a discussion. I was sure I had the upper hand on this one. I had all my facts lined up and was ready to go. About 15 seconds into it, I was on the other end. And I was losing. Did what I always did. Grabbed my bottle, stormed out the door, slammed it, jumped in the car, peeled out of the driveway, up the street, I'm out of here. Only thing different that Sunday, I still had my pajamas on. Well, my wife did what any caring, loving, thoughtful wife would do. She called a friend to come get me and bring me home. Only thing wrong with that is the friend she called happened to be a police captain. And he found me sitting in the Holiday Inn parking lot, minding my own business, talking to my bottle. And he came up and tapped on the car window. I looked up at him and said, "Hey, Harold." And he said, "Hey, Bill, why don't you come on and go with me?" And I told him he could. I said, "No, thank you." And he started talking to me about his relative size to mine and his Marine Corps wrestling career and the impact that that billy club hanging on his belt had up the side of one's head. And, you know, the more he talked, the more it made sense I might want to think about going with him. I mean, I was drunk, but I wasn't crazy yet. So I got out of the car and got into the police car with him, and we started out. I also wasn't so drunk that I didn't know that within about two blocks, we weren't headed toward my house. About two more blocks, I knew where we were headed because he pulled into the emergency room parking lot of a local hospital. And he pulled in there, opened the door with me inside, and I was checked into that hospital before I could say anything. Folks, I'm going to tell you something. You won't believe how fast you can get checked in a hospital when you already got your pajamas on. These hospitals have got a thing about guys in pajamas with vodka bottles in their hands sitting around in the parking lot and in the waiting room mumbling to themselves. So, you know, keep that in mind next time you got to go to the hospital and you don't want to deal with all those insurance papers and all that. Just go in with your pajamas on with a vodka bottle in your hand. That'd do it every time. I ended up upstairs in the hospital and was in there for a couple of weeks, and when I checked out of the hospital, those wonderful nurses and doctors had done a great job of taking care of my strep throat. Wait a minute. This is how that came about. You see, my policeman friend and my wife and the minister and the doctor and I think a few people they brought in off the street had a little meeting in the hospital that afternoon. And it was decided that, you know, Bill's on the radio every day, and he's sort of a celebrity in town, and everybody knows who he is, and the newspaper just left to get a hold of the fact that he's over here in detox, drying out. Why don't we put him up in the other regular part of the hospital, and we put a clipboard on his door that says he's got strep throat, and we can just detox him right along with everybody else. And they did such a fine job of it, and my denial clicked in so well that when I got out of there, I was convinced that's what they'd done, and that was terrible sore throat that they really had taken good care of me. And you know how long it took me to come to grips with what really happened in that hospital? When I was right in the fourth step, it finally came out. My denial was in well-oiled functioning order even back then. Well, finally my wife and I took the great American geographical cure for us drunks and decided to move. We moved to back to Atlanta for me, to Atlanta for the first time for my first wife. And one of the I-nevers that I had when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor used to say that I had the worst case of terminal uniqueness he'd ever seen. And one of my I-nevers was that I had never lost a home. I heard so many of you people say you lost everything, including your home. And I said, well, that, you know, that didn't happen to me. One more way, I'm not like you. But it did. It happened, and it was not until that first step this came out, too. You see, when we left Gainesville, Georgia, and we moved to Atlanta, we sold a very nice home there, and we decided we were going to do the smart thing, and we were going to put the equity out of that house in the bank, and we were going to live in an apartment for a little while until we could make up our minds what part of Atlanta we wanted to live in and what kind of house we wanted to buy. I mean, it made sense at the time. We took our time, all right. We lived in an apartment for 12 years. And drank up every dime of that equity. Couldn't afford a house if we'd wanted one. So, yes, we lost a home. It was at that point that I got involved in a facet of my career that had to do with a thing called public relations. And I didn't even know what public relations was. But I discovered several facets of it that I did like. A thing called a free martini lunch. Actually, I thought five martinis made more sense, but if you wanted to have three, that was your business. I discovered another thing that they had in Atlanta that they had not had in these other little towns I've lived in, called happy hour. That was where you buy one drink and they'd give you two. I mean, for real, two. I saw two drinks in front of me a lot of times, but this, they were really there, and I liked that idea. It was a good concept. it didn't take me very long to discover that if you took the 3 martini or 5 martini lunch and you stayed a little longer for that, and if you went to happy hour a little earlier, you could put the two together and you didn't have to go back to work in the afternoon. And I began to live in those bars. What I didn't realize, I did not see that my staff was very happy with the fact that I didn't come back to work in the afternoon. Because while the guy that would show up in the morning could be a pretty nice guy, the one that came back to work in the afternoon after one of those long lunches was surly and argumentative and judgmental. You see, my best friend in that bottle had begun to turn on me, to change me into something that I didn't like, and neither did anybody else. There were a lot of things that I didn't see. I didn't see the little 5-year-old girl was avoiding her daddy every chance she got. I didn't notice that she didn't invite friends home to spend the night anymore, because she didn't know when Dad was going to come home in the middle of the night in a drunken rage, picking up furniture and smashing it, throwing television sets through plate glass windows, dragging her out of bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, demanding that she clean up her room, or some other insane, crazy behavior. I didn't notice, because I was too much into that bottle, and my disease had me fully in its grip. I began to live in bars. I began to have more and more blackouts. More and more times I didn't come home at all at night. And I woke up in strange beds with strange people. I woke up in strange cities. And I can't tell you how many times I'd have to open a nightstand drawer in a motel room and pull out a phone directory to find out what town I was in. There were times when I would sit down in the early morning hours and I'd try to get my eyes open and piece together receipts from credit cards to figure out the trail of where I had been. That is, as long as I had credit cards, because it wasn't long before they went. You see, I like to use them, but I didn't like to pay for them, and they frown on that, so they take them away from you. And eventually, I couldn't even get a gasoline card. The pattern of coming home drunk in the middle of the night got to be worse and worse. And my wife would tell me in the morning what I had done, and I would start denying until she pointed around and showed me the evidence. She tell me the things that I had said and done to my little girl. And I'd come down in the morning, and I'd look down at this beautiful little blue-eyed, blonde-headed girl, and I would take her by the hand, and I'd say, "Karen, come on with me." And we'd go out and go walking out down the sidewalk together. And I'd say, "Sweetheart, Mama told me what Daddy did last night, but I don't remember. But I'll do promise you this. I promise you that will never, ever, ever happen again. I will never do that anymore." And I did not even notice that there was not even the faintest glimmer of belief in that little girl's eyes. We had taken too many walks, and she had heard too many empty promises, and she wasn't going to buy it anymore. But we kept taking the walks nonetheless. My life kept going further and further and further downhill. All of the morals and values that I had been taught as a child growing up in a very good home went right out the window. I ended up in places and doing things that in my wildest dreams could not have imagined that I would have. Now, I began drinking hard liquor in some of the fanciest places in Atlanta. Crystal stemware and all of that good stuff, because I thought, folks, this is class. I've arrived now. This is as classy as it gets. But I'm going to tell you, in those latter years of my drinking career, there was no more class. When you wake up in an Atlanta city park at 5 o'clock in the morning with dew all over your clothes, and when you wake up, you're looking out from under a bush and you realize what you're looking at is up the nostrils of a policeman's horse, there is no class in that. There is also no good comeback line either. That happened a lot of years ago, and I still hadn't thought of something good I could have said to that cop. There's no class when you're splayed over the trunk of a police car and frisked and cuffed and hauled away. There's no class when you sit at a bar and drink up your child's next week's lunch money, buying another round so that a bunch of drunks will stay and listen to you cry and babble. There is no class when the phone rings at a bar at 11 o'clock at night, and the bartender says it's for you. And on the other end of the line is a little 10-year-old daughter saying, "Daddy, please come home. Where's your mom?" "I don't know. Please, Daddy, I'm scared. Come home." And I say, "All right, sweetheart, I'm going to have one more drink. Just one more, and then I'll be right home." And all of you know the story. 10 drinks later and 3 hours later, I'd stumble into the house. And I'd find that beautiful little blue-eyed blonde girl curled up in the corner of her bed, trembling in fear and crying. You would think I would have gotten a message, but I didn't. By now, my marriage was completely on the rocks, falling apart at the seams. I never asked where my wife was going. She never asked where I was going. We went our separate ways. We got together at least 1 week to have a communication session for all the neighbors' benefit more than anything else. But one night, I'm sitting in my recliner chair at home, no class, just right out of the bottle. And my wife leaves, and she's gone for, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours. And she comes back, walks in the back door, and she walks into the den, and I'm still sitting there in my recliner chair, nursing my bottle, watching a television set that's not even turned on. And she stands in front of my chair and looks down and says, "Guess where I've been?" I said, "Who gives a, who cares?" And she said, she didn't say anything. She did something really weird. She flipped a white poker chip into my lap. I looked down at it, and I looked up at her, and I looked back at it, and I looked back at her, and I said, "I don't know where you've been, but if that's all you won, you had a lousy night." Well, you folks know where she'd been. And she told me where she'd been. To a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, folks, I went into a flying, pluperfect rage. I knew good and well, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that there was no way on the face of this earth that that woman was an alcoholic. She just absolutely couldn't be. Because I knew if she was, then it meant that, and well, she just wasn't. I mean, she couldn't have been. Didn't stop her. She started going every night and sometimes every day to those meetings. And I have to give her credit, though. She did not ever try to get me to go to one. She didn't say, "You're worse than I ever was, and you ought to be going, and you need this a lot worse." Never said anything like it. Never said a word about trying to get me. Well, you know, there were a few little clues around, like I could lift the toilet seat, and there's how it works. You know, but I get in the bed at night and run my arm under my pillow like I always sleep and open it up, and it's this little old pamphlet with all them questions in it. And I'd get to about the third one and go, "I ain't lost her." But she kept on going to those meetings, and something started happening. That woman was changing. I mean, we'd get ready to have one of our discussions, and I had the best arguments the world has ever seen, and she'd turn around and walk off. I mean, she wouldn't even stay there and hear me. You people were getting to her. Finally, it happened. I knew it was going to happen. I knew it. Just a matter of time that she said, "I'm going to get a 90-day chip tonight, and I'd like for you to call." I said, "No way. No." Well, we had a discussion, and there were some tears, and finally I said, "Yes, but on my conditions." You know, everything's always on my conditions. Well, my condition was I'm going in my own car, because she had said after that she went to these meetings that they got in the car and they went down the street to a place called Coco's and they had coffee and sat around. I knew that was a lie, but I didn't care where she was going. I just knew I wasn't going. I said, "Okay, I'll go in the meeting." She said, "You follow me." So I got in my car and I followed her from our apartment where we lived down Roswell Road in Atlanta to a little place called the 8111 Club. Now, what it is, it's a little house sitting back up in the trees off of the road, pretty little house sitting back up there. It was real ironic because I'd passed that house a lot of times,
and had thought that this guy, I needed to get to know the guy that lived in that house because he obviously had a party every night with all them cars. Well, that night, old Bill went to the party. And I walked into the back of that room, and I sat down behind the post. And for the next hour, I witnessed the biggest bunch of weirdos I'd ever seen in my life. They read a bunch of stuff, and then this one guy raised his hand and he started talking to him about the fact that he'd gotten two DUIs, and everybody in the room cracked up. Another said, guy said he got four DUIs and was arrested for indecent exposure. And they about came unglued. And I got to thinking, my God, if they heard some of the things that happened to me, I could sound like Richard Pryor in here. But I have to tell you very seriously, the thought that went through my mind that night, very clear even today, and I never want to forget it. The thought was, what are they laughing for? Don't they know what they are? They're alcoholics. They've got nothing to laugh about. I thank God every single day of my life for the laughter that we share in these rooms. I think there is so much healing and so much curing and so much power in this laughter. I think we need to do a little more of it. And I thank God that we can. But that night, I didn't understand it at all. Well, that meeting rattled on there, and people talked about everything under the sun, and finally it came around, and they went through this thing about the chips, and my wife got hers, and pretty soon everybody stood up, and I said, thank God this is over, and I started for the door, and somebody grabbed me by the hand from both sides. And then they said the only thing that was familiar to me that whole hour was the Lord's Prayer, and finally it was over, and I headed out that back door across that parking lot as fast as I could go. I got about halfway to my car, and suddenly something grabbed me by the shoulder that felt like a steel vise. Spun me around, and I found myself looking up into the face of a guy that looked like he was 7'11". I know today that he's only 6'6", but he looked a lot taller that night. I had remembered this guy. He was the only one that I remembered from that meeting. Because everybody in the meeting had identified themselves by saying, my name's Joe and I'm an alcoholic, or my name's Tom and I'm an alcoholic, or my name's Sue and I'm an alcoholic. This guy was different. He had said, my name's Floyd and I'm a grateful hillbilly drunk. Give me a break. This guy got to talking to me about drinking moonshine up in the mountains on Saturday night, and about him having a sixth grade education and coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going, God almighty, what is with this guy? What is he talking about? He don't even know who I am. Found out later he knew exactly who I was because she'd been talking about me in those meetings. People came out of the meeting, got in their cars and drove off. I went in my car so I could get out of here, you know. My wife walks out, says bye, gets in her car and leaves, and it's me and Floyd. He talked for what seemed like 4 hours. I know now it was only probably about 30, 40 minutes. It seemed a whole lot longer that night. And he rattled on and on about getting drunk in the wintertime and falling down in the woods and his face freezing to the ground. And they had to pour coffee on him to get him up. Now, I had had martinis at the Diplomat in downtown Atlanta that afternoon. Who in the hell is this guy talking to about? I finally got away from him, got in my car and drove home, walked in the back door. My wife started to say something. I said, don't open your mouth. I got a big old iced tea tumbler about that tall, put two ice cubes in it and filled it up with vodka. And I said, when I get through with this, we'll talk. Of course, as you all well know, when I got through with that, I couldn't talk. But the next day, I made it abundantly clear, don't ever, ever, ever try to get me back to that nut house again. And she didn't. And the days and weeks and months rocked on. And further, the roller coaster went down. There were more walks with my little girl. More empty promises. More friends lost. more lonely nights in bars at 3 o'clock in the morning praying for another drunk to come in so I'd have somebody to talk to. You know, I'm convinced with all my heart that the loneliest lonely on the face of this earth is a drunk in the last days before he either dies or finds AA. I hope to God I never feel that loneliness again. Finally, on the afternoon of July 26, 1982, I came out of a week-long blackout drunk. Don't remember anything about that week. And when I came out of the drunk, I was sitting in that old recliner chair in that apartment, all alone. In my left hand was an empty vodka bottle. In my right hand, there was a cocked and loaded .22 pistol. And I had not remembered picking up either one. And the thought that was going through my mind was, is this all there is? Is this really just all there is? Because if it is, you can have it. I've had enough. And as I looked at that bottle and I looked at that gun, through the fog of the twilight hours of that evening, there came a voice. Not the voice of an angel. Well, in a way, I think he is an angel. A great big old strapping angel by the name of Floyd. I love that man to death. He's a dear friend today. And through the fog of that evening came one line that he said. It was all I could remember he said in that parking lot that evening. But it was enough. The words that came through the fog were, when I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I expected God to open up the gates of heaven and let me in. He didn't. But he opened the gates of hell and let me out. And if where I was on the afternoon of July 26, 1982 can be any closer to hell on this earth, I pray to the God of my understanding that I never know what it is. I got up out of that old recliner chair and I went in the bathroom and I cleaned up as best I could. And I got in my car and I drove the couple of miles back to that little 8111 club up in the trees. And I stumbled in that back door, sat down behind that same post and peeked around to the front of the room. And folks, don't tell me our God doesn't have a sense of humor. Because there, chairing that meeting, sat my wife. She didn't see me till the end of the meeting. When I got up and took the longest walk I've ever taken in my life to the front of that room. And a man pressed a white poker chip into a trembling, sweating palm. And I walked all the way back to my seat. I like to believe, I choose to believe, I believe with all my heart that an old Bill Sanders walked to the front of that room that night and died, and that a new one walked away, thanks to you, thanks to God. Because by the grace of God and people like you in rooms like this, I have not found it necessary to take a drink since that night. That's a miracle. If you don't believe in miracles, stick around our rooms a little while. You'll come to believe. He told me very, 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 very early in my sobriety that I needed to get a sponsor. I didn't even know what a sponsor was. I thought a sponsor in my business is a guy that buys a commercial on the radio. I said, what do I want one of them for? Well, you explained what a sponsor was. And I said, okay, I'll get me a sponsor, but I'm going to do it like I've always done everything, scientifically and methodically. So, I looked around to find the sweetest, kindest, roly-poliest, white-haired old granddaddy that I could find. One that I knew would pat me on the head on a daily basis and say to me that he had never seen anybody that worked the program of AA as well as I was. And I asked a man by the name of Doc Crandall to be my sponsor. Jack back there knew him. Biggest mistake I ever made in my life. In the years that Doc Crandall was my sponsor, I don't remember him ever telling me one damn thing I wanted to hear. But he told me an awful lot that I needed to hear. Here's how we started off. Within 15 seconds after I asked him to be my sponsor, he says, okay, the first thing you're going to do every morning when you get out of bed is you're going to get down on your knees and you're going to ask God to keep you sober today. And the last thing you do before you get in bed at night is you say thank you. I said, well, Doc, I know that this God stuff is real important in the meetings I've been to. And I grew up going to church. I even taught Sunday school one time. And I just got to tell you, I'm really not comfortable with this knee business. He looked at me and said, I didn't say a damn thing about you being comfortable. Then I got real cocky and said, Doc, I thought this was a program of suggestion. He says, it is. I suggest you do it or get you another sponsor. That's how we started off. Then he gave me a copy of the big book. He said, I want you to take this book home, and I want you to sit down, and I want you to read the first five chapters of this book. I want you to read it very thoroughly, and then come back, and we're going to have a discussion about how you can make that work in your life. I said, all right, I can get into that. So I took that book. I stopped by the office supply place. I got me a couple of those highlighters. I got me some sharp pencils and a legal pad, and I went home, and I went to work. I read that book. I underlined. I highlighted. I struck through the steps that didn't have anything to do with me. I wrote in the margin stuff y'all hadn't thought of. I had about 12 pages of notes, and about a week later I called him. I said, okay, Doc, I'm ready. He said, come on over. Sat down in his den. I spread out my pad on the coffee table, and I opened up my big book. I got my highlighter and my pencils laid just right. He said, fire away. What you got? I said, okay, Doc, looking at this first step, as I interpret, and that's as far as I got. He said, hold it. That step don't need your interpreting. It needs your doing. But Doc, what I think it means is, he said, Bill, look closely. You'll see if they wrote it in English, it says what it means. Said, if you look real close, you'll see they put numbers by those steps so smart college boys like you can follow them. He was tough. That's how my trip through the steps started. One by one, two by two, he led me through. I'd come to him so many times after a hard day's work, and I'd say, Doc, I got a problem I need a little help on. I got this situation at work, and he'd say, what step are you using on it? I'd say, Doc, this ain't got nothing to do with steps. This is real life stuff. I got this personnel problem at work, and he said, just go look in the steps and see what step you need. I said, geez. I'd go back and I'd look in the steps a little while, and I'd come back and I'd say, Doc, there ain't nothing in the steps about dealing with personnel in a workplace. He'd go look again. I'd go look again and again and again, and suddenly a light would go on. There it is. Next time I'd come back again, this ain't nothing in the... There it is. And I finally came to believe, and I believe with all my heart today, that there is absolutely nothing that is going to happen in this alcoholic's life that an answer is not in that toolbox called the steps. And I do call it my toolbox because I can use it to fix anything that goes on in my life. Anything. I did say one time to Doc, I said, Doc, you know, I just realized something. Do you think God maybe speaks to us through people? He said, who do you think he speaks through, Frisbees? I also asked him, big mistake, I asked him, I said, Doc, suddenly occurred to me, we were whizzing along through these steps. I said, Doc, what do I do when I get through working these steps? He didn't bat an eye. He said, you lay real still because you're dead. Either way, one of the things Doc also instilled in me, he said, if you get into an argument in your head about whether or not you're going to take a drink, you will lose. If you get into an argument in your head about whether or not you'll take a drink, you will lose. I heard it here, but I didn't hear it here, where it counts. A few months after I got sober, I had to take a business trip to Washington, D.C. Well, my plane hadn't cleared the ground at Hartsfield International Airport in Atlanta till the meeting started up here. 800 miles from home. Nobody up there knows you're in AA. You can tie one on tonight, and by the time you get back Friday, it'll be out of you. You notice I didn't say have a drink. I ain't never said have a drink. I don't even understand the concept of a drink. What good is a drink? It better be a real big drink. I've said so many times, even today, nearly 11 years later, occasionally I'm sitting at lunch in a restaurant in downtown Atlanta, and I look across at the table and across over here, and there's some guy orders a martini, and he sits there and stirs it with his finger for 30 minutes, orders lunch and eats, and still got that martini sitting there, and gets up and leaves half of it. There is a part of me that still wants to chase him out in the parking lot and say, get back in there and finish that drink. I don't understand people like that. But all the way to Washington, this meeting goes back and forth in my head. Yes, no, you can, you can't, you should, you shouldn't. I even looked around the cabin of that airplane to see if anybody else was hearing those voices. They weren't. Plane touched down at National Airport, out of the plane, into a cab, headed for the Hyatt Regency Hotel on Capitol Hill, and the meeting's still going on. And I'm listening. Out of that cab, into that big atrium lobby of that hotel, and my radar spotted that bar in an eighth of a second, all the way on the other side of the room. Music, the tinkling of the glasses. It took less than 10 minutes to check in, get upstairs, dump my bag, get down, and stood in the doorway of that bar for 3 or 4 minutes as the meeting played out. And I lost. And I walked over and sat down at the bar. The bartender came and stood in front of me, smiled, and said something really weird. She said, "Hiya, pal. How about a Coke?" "A what?" He said, "I figured by that lapel pin you're wearing, that's what you'd want. I had forgotten to take off this damn AA pin." He sat down the Coke, went down the bar, served 2 or 3 more people, came back and stood in front of me again. I'm still sitting there staring at that Coke. He said, "You ain't got any business in here, do you?" "No." He said, "Where you belong is 3 blocks down the street, upstairs over the furniture store. There's a meeting in 20 minutes. Get the hell out of here." I went to that meeting that night. And after that meeting was over, I did 2 things. First, I walked back into a bar, and I thanked the bartender for saving my life. He smiled and he laughed and he said, "You weren't in very much danger in here. When I saw you standing in the doorway, I thought you were looking for somebody. But when you sat down and I saw that pen, I knew what you were doing. And there was no way in hell you were getting a drink out of me tonight." And the second thing I did is I got down on my knees in a hotel room in our nation's capital. And I said to the God you had introduced me to, "If you've gone to this much trouble to keep me sober tonight, I will never test you again." And I haven't. I stay out of bars because I've got no business there. I don't belong there. My sponsor, Doc, used to say to people, and they'd say, "Well, the only reason I went to hear the band." He'd say, "Buy their damn record." And if they ain't got any records, then they're not worth listening to. I don't go in bars. I got no reason to go in bars. God love him, Doc. One of the big problems when I came to AA that I had is not understanding what was in it for you. You see, this thing called unconditional love, I didn't know what that was. Love always had strings attached to it. Strings, hell, had chains attached to it. I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't figure out what your motive was. Till one night. I walked into a meeting and Doc said, "Hey, Bill, there's a newcomer here tonight. He's got a similar background to yours. Stick around after the meeting. We're going to go back there in the front room and talk with him a little bit." I said, gosh, Doc, I really do appreciate you thinking of me, but I had a real rough day today. I got a headache. I hadn't had a bite to eat. I'm going to have to get home. Catch me another time. He said, you don't understand. We're going to talk to this newcomer after this meeting, and you're going to stay. Yeah, okay. 2.5 hours after that meeting was over, I left in my car, and I headed up Roswell Road toward my home. And I had to pull over the side of the road with tears streaming down my face. Because suddenly, I got it. I found out what the payoff was for you. I found out what your motive was. Because for that couple of hours, this self-centered, egotistical, alcoholic drunk had gotten out of himself and thought more about somebody else than he did himself. I had never felt anything like it in my life. It was fantastic. I went home, got on the phone, I called Doc. He had just had time to walk in the door at his house, and I started going, I said, Doc, this is the greatest thing I've ever... Do you realize, and my headache, I don't, it's not even, and the hunger, I don't care what... And he just listened to me. Finally, I started talking to him about going down to the jails and pulling people out and going to the hospitals and dragging... Then Doc started talking about easy does it. But I found out the payoff that night. I found out a secret that's been my secret ever since then. The secret's very simply this. Every day of my life, try just a little bit to pay back the debt that I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous for what's been given to me. Tell you a little secret. You won't get close. Because the more you give, you get about 900 times more back, and you end up deeper in debt, but happier. Works every time. I referred my sponsor, Doc, in the years that he was my first sponsor. On November 25th, 1985, Doc went on a 12-step call and never came home. As he and another man talked with a young fellow that Doc had been working with for several years to try to help him get sober, there was a struggle over a shotgun from the suicidal young man. And the shotgun went off, and Doc caught it full in the stomach and died on the way to the hospital. And in the twilight hours of that evening, I watched the sun go down outside of Doc's study window. And I thought, how can I go on? How can I possibly continue without the man who has guided my footsteps, who has led me every step of the way? How can I go? In the quiet stillness of that evening, the answer came. You do it by doing the things he taught you to do. And the things that his sponsor taught him, and that his sponsor taught him, and his sponsor taught him, all the way back to that fateful night in the spring of 1935, when the broken-down stockbroker and the little has-been doctor said, do you think we might be able to stay sober if we help one another? My granddaddy's sponsor died in 1989, 9 days after his 40th birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was very fond of saying that he believed with all his heart that in 1935, our loving God looked down and said, the lowly alcoholic has suffered long enough. I've got to give him a way out. And look at what he gave us. We could have been locked away forever, and some of us should have been. We could have been put away in colonies like lepers, as many of us felt. But instead, he gave us the most wonderful way of life that most of us have ever known. More love than any of us had ever felt. More friends than any of us had ever imagined. And then he topped it off with a relationship with him that few people on this earth ever get to know. What a wonderful way to treat a terminal illness. I still wondered how I'd make it without Doc in my life. And before I could wonder very long, I was surrounded by some of the most wonderful sponsorees in the world. And those fellas loved me, and they carried me to meetings when I didn't want to go. They wouldn't let me be alone when I wanted to isolate. They made me talk when I didn't want to talk. And they loved me back to health until I could get on the straight and narrow again. Till I could get, as Doc liked to say, into the middle of the bed. He always said that. He said, get in the middle of the bed, because nobody ever fell out of the middle of a bed. If you're hanging around the edges, you're going to fall off. I referred in my talk to this woman that was my first wife. And I say that she was my first wife because, you see, I'm not married to the same woman today. And she's not, thank God, married to the same man either. They're the same people. They're the same bodies. But they are not the same. On December 30th, 1982, at a time when there should have been divorce papers being signed, instead, my wife and I stood before the same minister who had married us 16 years before, renewed our vows, and started all over again. And she's here with me this morning, and she is the best friend I have in this world, and I love her with all my heart. And I'm going to embarrass her and make her stand up. I got to share one thing with you about her, though, going to that first AA meeting when she got that white chip. It actually started before that, and she lets me tell you this, but about 2 years before that, she had gone to an Al-Anon meeting to find out what to do about that drunken SOB at home. But she went to the Al-Anon meeting caught to the gills. And they ticked her off because they suggested she might be in the wrong room. So she left for 2 years. But the life of this woman and me is centered around Alcoholics Anonymous. Our friends are in Alcoholics Anonymous. The anchor of our life is in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because my sobriety takes priority over anything else. Because without it, I won't have anything else. My sponsor said to me one time, your disease had better be the number one priority in your life because it's going to be one way or the other. And I had enough of the other. I want to close by sharing with you one last little story. On the 15th of February of last year, I took another walk with my little girl, that beautiful little blue-eyed blonde. This time the walk was down the aisle of a church. And boy, did she look beautiful that day. That long, white, flowing gown. Me in that monkey suit, I looked like a penguin. But she was gorgeous. And I looked down at her and smiled. And the music started and we started down the aisle of that church and tears started pouring. And I walked her to the front of the church and put her hand in the young man that she was marrying's hand. And she started a new chapter in her life. She's married to a fine young man. My wife and I love him very much. He worried me a great deal the first time we met him. The first night we met him when we took him, the two of them out to dinner. The first thing he did when we walked into a restaurant and sat down is he ordered a beer. And then he sat there and nursed that thing for 2 hours. And I told him, son, you ain't never going to make it in my little fellowship. And he won't. He loves to go to AA meetings. He goes at least a couple of times a year when his in-laws get their chips. And he loves the love and he loves the laughter and he loves the camaraderie of Alcoholics Anonymous. But on the wedding day of our little girl, that's not when the greatest tears were to come. The greatest tears were to come at the reception that followed. You see, a few weeks before the wedding, my little girl had said, Daddy, at the reception, I want to have the first dance with Paul, but I want to have the second dance with you. And I said, oh, me, Karen, honey, Daddy used to dance a whole lot like Fred Astaire and John Travolta, but he doesn't dance quite that good anymore. He doesn't dance near as good as he never did. Um, I said, I'll tell you what, you better tell me what music we're going to dance to, and maybe I can practice a little bit with your mom. And she said, no, I don't want to tell you. Okay. We got to the reception, and the handsome young prince and princess danced out onto the dance floor. She in her beautiful gown, and they did look like a prince and princess. And I stood at the edge of the dance floor and watched along with several hundred other people. And then that song ended. And my little girl came and stood in front of me. And she smiled, and she took my hand. And the music began. And the words of the song were, "Did you ever know that you're my hero? And everything I'd like to be. I can fly higher than an eagle. You are the wind beneath my wings." Oh, dear God, what a miracle had been worked in the life of this family. Destroyed by alcohol, wrecked and ruined. And you and a loving God had put them all back together again. And as we danced, I looked into my little girl's eyes, and I saw love, and I saw respect. You don't believe in miracles? You only have to look around. I can tell you this. There is no beer that's ever been brewed. There is no liquor that's ever been distilled that could produce the high that I felt that day. There is no drink that can produce the high that I feel most days of my life because of what you have given to me and to my family. We owe you our lives. I happen to believe with all my heart that if you're not happier, most days, if you're not happier than you've ever been in your life and you got a hole in your program somewhere, and you need to go look in those steps. I have to do it frequently. Life still happens, yes. Tragedy still comes along, yes. But what a wonderful toolbox to deal with it. And what wonderful support. And so in closing, I would say to you, did you ever know that you are my heroes? And you are everything I want to be. And together we can all soar like eagles. Because he is the wind beneath our wings. God bless you, and thank you very much.